an ancient manuscript suggesting Jesus was married, a German museum director turned Florida pornographer, a renowned Harvard professor of divinity. These are the elements that make up the unbelievable tale of Jesus' wife, an article from the July issue of The Atlantic magazine by journalist Ariel Sabar. Sabar joins the ProPublica podcast today to tell us how he uncovered the story of Walter Fritz, a shifty jack-of-all-trades from Germany who duped world-class religious scholars into thinking he possessed documented evidence showing Christ had been married. Ariel, thank you for joining us.
Sure. It was a bit of a random assignment, and it came back in the fall of 2012 when Smithsonian Magazine, who I'd been freelancing for, said that they could have gotten word of this ancient papyrus that Karen King at Harvard was going to announce in a few weeks, but that Karen King was giving a few media outlets kind of an advance look at the papyrus. I mean, she was aware that this was a piece of history that could be misinterpreted in a lot of ways, that she was concerned that people would take it as an official marriage certificate for Jesus and Mary Magdalene, when, in fact, all she was claiming was that this was evidence that one group of early Christians believed Jesus was married. So she wanted to bring in some, I guess, what she viewed as sort of high-credibility media, and that included the Smithsonian Magazine, the New York Times, and the Boston Globe. And we were given the opportunity separately to come to meet with Karen King at Harvard, see the papyrus, because Smithsonian is a magazine, and you know they wanted to tell not just a sort of one-day news story around it, but a full feature. They said, you know, we'd also love for you to follow Karen King to Rome when she announces this find in front of a group of fellow scholars at this international conference. And so I was like, great, that sounds interesting. I didn't know a whole lot about the New Testament or ancient manuscripts, but I had to learn very fast because I think the time from the initial assignment to when we were going to post the story on the web, we were going to post one story on the web as soon as King announced and then do another rewrite for the November 2012 issue of the magazine. It was something like 3.5 weeks. I had to really, you know, gear up and to get...
Take a crash course.
A crash course on the New Testament, the Gnostic Gospels, various theories about whether Jesus would have been married or not, all in about 3.5 weeks. And so that was my kind of crash course introduction to it. And, you know, I wrote the story for Smithsonian, again, 1 6,000-word piece for the web, and then we put a new top on it with live reporting from Rome for the November 2012 issue of the magazine. And I just still remember the splash the story created. I mean, there was this incredible kind of resonance throughout popular culture and also within this sort of, you know, fusty world of biblical scholarship.
Right, because the discovery of this manuscript is highly, highly significant in the world of biblical scholarship, obviously, right? I mean, it sort of sends ripples through that whole unique little world. And so to take us back to the reaction from that 2012 feature, what kind of response did you get from it?
I mean, it was pretty overwhelming. It was one of those stories where, like, you start looking at the kind of social media metrics, you know, the Facebook likes or tweets or whatever, and it's just going through the roof. I remember the Jesus Wife hashtag started circulating. Paul Rudnick did a Shouts and Murmurs piece for The New Yorker around the discovery. Stephen Colbert talked about it on his show. So it's not only sort of rippling out into, you know, the scholarly community, but it's also making its way into popular culture. There are, like, cartoonists and newspapers about it. And it was pretty heady. I remember getting a phone call even, you know, when I was in Rome from PBS NewsHour saying, you know, can we get this guy in front of a camera as soon as possible? And, you know, to write a story that's about, you know, a scholarly find and to get that sort of reaction so instantly, you know, that's one of the stories that you continue to think about. And I continue to think about even after I had to move on to other stories, which I did have to do. You know, I wrote this story for Smithsonian, and because I'm a full-time author and magazine journalist, you know, it wasn't something I could continue to follow beyond perhaps getting the occasional Google News alerts when there was some ripple or hiccup.
And now, in the years since, there begins to blossom some real skepticism over whether or not this is a forged document. Take us through some of the early skeptics and their...
Sure. Right away, I mean, I was the only reporter in the room when Karen King announced this discovery. And right afterwards, people in the room, I think even one guy sort of stood up and applauded. It was such a sort of shock to everything scholars thought they knew. But by the next day when I showed up at the conference, already some of these the prominent scholars of Coptic, which is an ancient Egyptian language in which the Gospel of Jesus' Wife is written, and in the study of papyri, were already raising questions about various problems with this tiny text. One of them was sort of some grammatical problems. Others had to do with the fact that every single line on this very, very small business card size scrap seemed to form a semantic unit. In other words, it all each of the lines, even though this was cut out of a much bigger codex or ancient book, each of the lines seemed to sort of create meaning, which is a little bizarre for something that small. And then there were very quickly, within a few days, a scholar in the United Kingdom picked up on some similarities between the language in the Gospel of Jesus' Wife and in an authentic gospel known as the Gospel of Thomas. So very quickly there grows this very lively discussion, not in, interestingly, this is another story perhaps, not in sort of peer-reviewed journals, which take forever to publish, but on scholarly blogs. And you have all these scholars kind of weighing in on, you know, new clues they're finding that are starting to raise questions about the authenticity of this, you know, remarkable piece of antiquity.
So then you take on the incredibly daunting task of trying to really trace back its provenance. And one of the, you know, first important characters that you come into contact with, who's no longer living, is Hans Ulrich Laukamp. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, I think that's more or less correct.
And so tell us about him.
Sure. So, you know, one of the things as I continue to follow, you know, the spasms of brief sort of news coverage here and there about the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, there's this back and forth between the critics of the fragment who had found these problems with the text, with the text itself, with grammar, and then the scientific test that Harvard had conducted, which showed that the papyrus material itself was ancient and that there was no evidence in the ink chemistry of the ink being modern. And that doesn't mean that the ink itself is ancient, it's just that it doesn't have, like, say, the ingredients of a big pen in it or something that were manufactured well after antiquity. So there was this kind of stalemate between the critics and Karen King. And one of the things that just troubled me, and perhaps this is just, you know, a reporter's instinct, is that, you know, we're always told as reporters to ask, you know, what is the source of your information? Who is bringing you this cache of sensational documents? You want to know a little bit about them. You can't tell everything from the document itself. So that's why how I became interested in sort of asking the question, great, we have the scientific test, we know what the scholars think about the text, but who owns this thing? Where did this thing come from? And we knew very, very little about that. You know, Karen King, in her one article, the journal article about the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, tells everything she knows about where the papyrus comes from. She cannot disclose the name of the current owner because he has asked for anonymity. But she does relate the story that the current owner tells her about where he acquired the papyrus. And that story involves a gentleman named Hans Ulrich Laukamp, who allegedly sold the papyrus to the current owner back in 1999. And the current owner claimed that Hans Ulrich Laukamp even had a couple of letters from a Berlin Free University Egyptologist vouching for the papyrus, saying that he'd actually seen the papyrus in 1982 and had an opinion about it. And so there's this modern provenance paper trail that's out there around the provenance questions of where this came from. And Karen King dutifully, you know, reports that in her article. And the only central figure in that story is a gentleman whom we really know absolutely nothing about, whom Karen King knows nothing about. All we know is his name, and that is Hans Ulrich Laukamp.
And you go and meet some of his family in Berlin, and you begin to kind of build a dossier on him. What ends up going into that dossier, and sort of take us through what you learned about Hans?
Yeah, I use sort of the tried and tested tools of investigative reporters everywhere, which is to begin with public documents. And, you know, after doing a number of searches, we realized there was really only ever one Hans Ulrich Laukamp who had ever lived in the United States. I should let you know that I had a few additional clues because Karen King in 2012 gave me emails that the anonymous current owner had exchanged with her while he was courting her interest in papyrus. So I had a sense that she scrubbed all the names, you know, and email addresses out, so I had no idea who the owner was. But there were some clues in that email chain that at some point the papyrus had exchanged hands in the United States, even though Hans Ulrich Lecompte was allegedly this German guy. So I started, you know, searching public records and find that there's one Hans Ulrich Lecompte, and he lived in one place, and that was in the United States, and that was in Venice, Florida, which is this retirement community on the Gulf Coast. And as I started looking at who he worked with and who was in business with him during his very, very brief time in the United States, I was able to identify his gentleman named René Ernest, who wound up being his stepson. And so I had to, at that point, you know, I worked for a while with public records to kind of flesh out the network of people that knew Hans Ulrich Lecompte. And one of the people I identified was his stepson, who, when I eventually traveled to Germany to continue this investigation, I would go speak to. I guess the other thing that's important for folks to know is that every single person in the provenance story, the public provenance story that was out there, that, and that includes Hans Ulrich Lecompte and the two professors who he allegedly consulted in 1982, every single person in that story was dead, which meant that there was no one, like any reporter or even any professor, could go to alive who could contradict the story that the current owner was telling about where the papyrus came from. And that's why it made it critical for me as a journalist to identify people who knew the deceased, essentially, to find people who knew Hans Ulrich Lecompte, to find people who knew the two Berlin professors who had allegedly seen this thing, so that I could start asking them questions about the papyrus and about the owner might be.
So you end up finding some of his relatives in Berlin, and take us into that scene. What did they tell you about the kind of person that he was?
Sure, yeah. So I don't speak German, so I hired a wonderful German fixer and interpreter to work with me, and I've been a reporter long enough to know that on stories like this, you don't sort of call in advance and request an interview. You have to just show up at people's doors. And so because of the public records in the United States where their relatives' addresses were listed in Berlin, we were able to find the apartment, but, you know, visited about four times before anyone was home. And finally, on the fourth time, someone answered the door, and we told them why we were there, and they let us into this dimly lit living room and met with René Ernest and his wife, and they were, you know, very nice people. And, you know, they said that Hans Ulrich Lecompte was a very simple man. He was a guy who had no more than an eighth-grade education. He was a machinist, a toolmaker. Yeah, you know, he liked to go out for beers most days of the week at his local pub across the street. You know, not particularly educated. When we raised the question of whether he might have collected papyri, they sort of went bug-eyed, as if I've made a joke of some kind. He just wasn't the sort of guy who, you know, concerned himself with intellectual matters, with ancient history, with collecting really anything. And so the idea that he was this, owned these, you know, these potentially explosive papyri struck them as unbelievable. And just didn't make sense for the man that they knew and had spent, much of their lives with.
And how were you feeling upon this discovery?
This was more confirmation for some of what I had already gathered in earlier telephone interviews, which was that Hans Ulrich Lecompte does not fit the profile of a manuscript collector. We've all heard stories about some old grandpa somewhere who has some Rembrandt hiding in their closet. I mean, a lot of those stories don't wind up being true, but you know, they do happen. But it was another piece in the puzzle for me, and it was another, I guess what it did is it made me doubt the story that Hans Ulrich Lecompte could have had this piece of papyrus. But I also knew that there was a lot more to report. It was sort of that first tantalizing piece of evidence that Hans Ulrich Lecompte didn't fit the bill. He wasn't likely to have had this piece of papyrus, but it wasn't enough. I needed more evidence to be able to go there.
Right. So you take this piece of very tantalizing evidence, as you just put it, and connect it to a fascinating figure, a guy named Walter Fritz. Tell us about your kind of earliest detection of him and earliest impressions of him.
Well, this link is actually, for me, was kind of the bigger reveal because, you know, Hans Ulrich Lecompte's name was out there, but no one really had any sense of who else knew him or was affiliated with him. So as I'm poking around through public records in Florida, and thank goodness Florida has some of the best public records laws in the country, you know, looking at business associates of Hans Ulrich Lecompte. So we know Hans Ulrich Lecompte ran an auto parts business. His company manufactured a small but important brake components for BMW vehicles, which is something I also learned the course of reporting. And very briefly, I guess there was an effort by Lecomte to perhaps open a branch of this business in Venice, Florida. Why Venice, Florida? Still a bit of a mystery, but there's no like auto manufacturing base there. There is a BMW factory in South Carolina. It's a bit far away. Anyway, so they open this branch, although it never gets beyond just sort of a business incorporation, in Venice, Florida. And I look at the names of a couple of other people on that incorporation who are listed as directors of the business other than Lecomte. And one of those people is a man named Walter Fritz. And what I started doing then was like, okay, so who is Walter Fritz? Who are these other people that are in business with him? And as I ran Walter Fritz's name through Florida incorporation records, a very curious business came up, and it was called Nefer Art. I didn't really know what Nefer meant, but I knew it sort of struck me as a possibly Egyptian word. I was thinking sort of Nefertiti, and looked it up. Nefer means beauty. So he has a company that has an Egyptian name, and it's not really clear what it does because it doesn't have a web presence anymore. It never seemed to have a brick and mortar, storefront anywhere. And it struck me as a little unusual that a man who was running a metal making auto parts business in Florida would have a business partner who is engaged in some kind of Egyptian art business. And that right away was like, wait a second, what's going on here? I remember just stopping cold and going, okay, who is this guy? I think I just started playing around with Google searches a bit and searches of scholarly journals, almost just on a lark, and dropped in the name Walter Fritz and the word Egypt. And, Walter Fritz is a fairly common German name, so there were a lot of completely useless Google hits. But there appear to be a few references in a few scholarly articles to an article written by a Walter Fritz in 1991 for a German Egyptology journal. And I thought, okay, well, that's weird, because now we have a Walter Fritz who is not only interested in Egyptian art, but he is active in the German Egyptology community at some point in the past. And I knew this was important because of these two former Berlin Egyptologists who had allegedly looked at the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. I think the one of the bigger reveals for me was when I then started looking at, I got a copy of this old journal, German Egyptology journal, and Walter Fritz's affiliation is listed as the Free University of Berlin. I'm like going, oh great, this has got to be significant because the Free University, exactly the university where these two professors who looked at the Gospel of Jesus' Wife and the Gospel of John, and the Gospel of John was another papyrus that the current owner possessed, that is also referenced in these articles, it's the same university. Like, maybe it's pure coincidence. Walter Fritz, again, is a very common German name. But the fact that he turns up at the same university as these two scholars that looked at it, for me, was another like huge breadcrumb.
Right. So just to pause for a moment here and tick off where you're at with the story, you have tracked down Hans Ulrich Lecomte, who's sort of the closest thing to an owner of this Jesus's Wife fragment, find out this guy is far from an Egyptian or biblical scholar, but he has this business partner in his auto body company who looks to be, certainly an Egyptian art enthusiast and has worked for a university that has a focus on these things. This is a pretty significant pivotal moment. You're beginning to connect the dots here. So how were you feeling in that moment? I mean, you must have been terribly excited, I'd imagine.
I was excited, but I was also sort of, riven with doubt because part of me felt like, okay, this is a pretty tantalizing clue, and if I'm right, it's going to be transformative. If I'm wrong, I've just wasted the last couple of months. But it's one of those things I think reporters sometimes develop a feeling in their gut about something that this is worth a certain amount of speculative reporting. We don't do that often, but I think all of us who've reported in investigative pieces, and of course the folks at ProPublica know that intimately, that there comes a time when something in your gut tells you that you are at a pivot point. And this was that pivot point for me, but I also knew that it could pivot in both directions. And so the question I needed to answer was, were these two Walter Fritzes the same man? And my first instinct was, well, why don't I just call Walter Fritz up? Or actually, better still, why don't I go to Florida and knock on his door and ask him? And I travel to Florida, drive out that afternoon to Walter Fritz's house, and right away I see that I'm not going to be able to get in. There's a big gate in front of his property. There's no doorbell or intercom. There's a no trespassing sign. It actually explicitly warns against entering and that you'll be charged with a felony. And, you know, in Florida's also, you know, has stand your ground laws, and you just have to be careful. My hope of sort of knocking on his door and asking him didn't really pan out, so I went back to my hotel and I called him. You know, I said, among other things, I said, I'm here in Florida researching Hans Ulrich Kopp and the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, and I'd love to meet with you. And he gets pretty defensive. He doesn't want to meet with me. He claims that he didn't really know Hans Ulrich Kopp that well. He just helped him incorporate his business. When I asked Walter Fritz whether he's the same Walter Fritz who studied at the Free University and wrote this 1991 article, he said he denies that he is. And when I asked him whether by chance he is the owner of the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, he says he is not. And so he is clearly trying to throw me off his trail and, you know, essentially distance himself from the papyrus and from Hans Ulrich Kopp, sort of playing ignorant about it. The sort of important step here, I think, if the question is about sort of reporting tools, is once someone has lied to you, do you walk away and say, okay, I guess he's not the guy, story, you know, game over, or do you sort of go with that gut feeling you have, again, which is that there's something more here? And that gut feeling stayed with me, and I wound up calling the local newspaper in the small Florida town where Walter Fritz lives and said, do you have any photographs that you've ever taken of Walter Fritz? The local newspaper had covered some local environmental controversy that he had been in, kind of a neighborhood activist in. And they said, sure, we have a photo. And I said, great, can you email it to me? And so they emailed me a photo of Walter Fritz. And then I emailed it to a longtime professor at the Free University. And I said, is there any way that the man pictured in this photograph is the same person who wrote this article back in 1991? And the professor wrote back to me the next day and said, yeah, looks like him. He was a master's student here 2 decades ago. He dropped out of the Egyptology program without getting his PhD, and no one had ever heard from him again. I have no idea where he is now. And that was sort of the biggest punch in the gut for me, I guess in a good way, that my instincts were right, that Walter Fritz wasn't just a sort of random associate of Hans Ulrich Kopp, but had actually had studied Egyptology at the very university of these other key figures in the Jesus' Wife saga. And then I also knew that he had lied to me.
Right.
And when you learn that a subject, someone has lied to you, you have to ask yourselves, well, why did they lie to me? Right. That was the story of how I made the connection between.
And then you end up talking to a number of associates who kind of give you a similar impression, right? I mean, one man describes him as an eel and sort of somebody that is very elusive and a real self-promoter. What did people tell you about the kind of man Walter Fritz was?
I mean, Walter Fritz was a guy who was extremely intelligent, who, you know, showed a lot of promise in the field of Egyptology while he was at the Free University. Early on, he got this paper published while he was still a master's student. But people also told me that he was kind of hard to pin down. I mean, one source, business associate, described him as an eel, somebody you could never get your fingers around, that he was, you know, a very good salesman. He also had a tendency to appear and reappear, almost Zelig-like, in different jobs. So, you know, he was a guy who, at various points in his life, was, you know, a real estate agent, an Egyptology student, an auto parts manufacturing executive. Somehow, very quickly after he leaves the Free University Egyptology program, he lands a position as the director of the Stasi Museum. This is a museum that is within the headquarters of the former sort of notorious East German secret police. He's able to convince the people founding this museum that he can lead a museum in a subject he knows absolutely nothing about. He doesn't last long in that job. And like a lot of the jobs he's had over the years, he sort of goes in and he kind of makes a splash, but then something seems to sort of go awry at some point. And then he kind of pulls a Houdini and he kind of disappears. And no one in these places ever hears from him again. His life is very compartmentalized. I mean, he has portions of his life where the people knew him, but only for a brief period of time. So one of the other struggles as a reporter in covering this was that Walter Fritz wasn't somebody where you could go to a single source and say, tell me everything you know about Walter Fritz, because there was no person who could do that.
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds like there were a couple of times, and I'd love for you to elaborate on these, where the trails kind of turned cold, where it became very difficult to assemble a collection of facts about who Walter Fritz was.
Yeah, there were a lot of dead ends. I mean, not only because, you know, at first he had lied to me about who he was, but also because he's not someone who I don't think has a wide social network. When I heard from one professor in Berlin that they heard that he had wound up at some museum in Berlin, but they weren't sure which one, but they remembered, for instance, that there had been a brief write-up about it in the magazine Stern, which is a famous German magazine, back in the early 1990s. They couldn't tell me in what section, what year, what month. And so that was another kind of shot in the dark. But fortunately, I guess for me, my neighborhood library is the Library of Congress, and I just went there one day and said, can you pull every single issue of Stern you have from, you know, 1991 to 1994? And I remember, you know, showing up at the library, and there's a big, heavy wooden cart loaded with these bound volumes of Der Stern. I don't speak German again, so I was really just looking for, you know, a mention of his name. And then, sure enough, after about an hour of turning pages, I was lucky, it could have taken a lot longer than that, there's this blurb in the sort of people section, you know, there's, which mostly deals with, you know, there were celebrities, that, you know, there was a Glenn Close write-up and a LaToya Jackson write-up. And there, in the middle of that, is a picture of Walter Fritz, you know, pictured in front of a painting of Erich Mielke, who was the former head of the Stasi, and announcing his appointment to this new job. So there are a lot of places along the way where we kind of hit dead ends, and we had to be creative about kind of what was our next chess move going to be to try to not lose his trail, because it was very easy to lose his trail.
Right. And then you have another amazing reporting coup where you're able to look up some of the domain names that he had registered over the years, which leads you to a whole nother world he's involved in. So tell us about that.
Sure. I mean, I started looking at using various kinds of internet searches and Whois searches, which look at the registration of web domains. I knew he seemed to have designed, I guess, his own website, which had been taken down a couple of years after the Gospel of Jesus' Wife was announced. But thanks to tools like the Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine, you can go back and kind of reconstruct what websites looked like in the past. So I found the NeferArt website, and it looked like he had designed a few other websites, and I wanted to get a better sense of that. And so I started doing some searches, and the first breakthrough I made was that Walter Fritz had registered the domain name gospelofjesuswife.com 3 weeks before Karen King announces the Gospel of Jesus' Wife to the world. And that was the first solid link I had that Walter Fritz could no longer deny having any association with the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Because 3 weeks before Karen King announced the Gospel of Jesus' Wife to the world, there was only a very, very small group of people that knew about it. And so he had to be among that inside group. Later, as I did more sophisticated searches of domain registrations by various kinds of identifiers linked to Walter Fritz, including his name, there came up a whole series of pornographic websites that he ran as a business with his wife, in which his wife is sort of a star of these pornographic videos and these websites. They work, I discovered, within a genre, kind of a fetish genre of porn called Hot Wife. And the fantasies within Hot Wife are built around wives who, with sort of insatiable lusts, whose husbands are unable to restrain them and who have sex with essentially other men.
I mean, you must have been thinking at this point, like, who the hell is this guy? He's like a pseudo-Egyptian scholar. He's an auto parts executive. Oh, yeah, he's also got a side business where he makes porn with his wife involving other men having sex with her.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously a really complicated man, and I wanted to kind of understand him in all of that complexity. And how do you put all those pieces together? Because he did seem to have so many identities, or at least a very complicated single identity. And I wondered whether there was any possibility that all those identities somehow found expression in the Gospel of Jesus' Wife.
Right. And this is a really fascinating aspect of it. Could you kind of unspool the connective thread between Fritz and his wife's fascination with sex and their sex business and Fritz's sort of motive? Or, you know, if he even has one, to dupe religious scholarly experts?
Yeah, that was one of the things that, again, I was telling my own wife about some of these websites. And she sort of asked me, have you ever read The Da Vinci Code? And I said, well, I haven't, but I know about it. And I could, you know, I know that it's sort of a publishing juggernaut and it's a very popular book. And I, of course, had referenced it in my Smithsonian article back in 2012 because that book kind of popularized the idea of Jesus having been married to Mary Magdalene. So I very quickly went and bought the Da Vinci Code and read it and saw that there were some interesting parallels between not just the content of the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, but the provenance story of the Gospel of Jesus' Wife. Because in the Da Vinci Code, a Harvard professor of religious symbology, whatever religious symbology is, that's what they call it in the book, basically solves the mystery of this long-lost secret of Jesus' marriage thanks to a coded message on a scrap of papyrus. And I'm thinking, like, okay, and part of the story of the Da Vinci Code is that part of what was suppressed by the, you know, figures within the Catholic Church was a Christianity that was much more, to use a modern term, sex positive, where sex could be holy, where sexual intercourse was kind of a religious rite, and that we didn't need to stigmatize or marginalize women within Catholicism particularly, but we should celebrate them, and that they should be equals with men, and that the union of male and female is where the divinity is. And as I'm thinking about this, and I'm trying to think about the Da Vinci Code, and I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, Karen King is a Harvard professor. Karen King is a Harvard professor to whom someone who believes in the divinity, and we can talk about more about this, who believes in the power of female sexuality, brings her a papyrus that will help vouch for a marriage between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. I'm thinking this sounds a whole lot like the Da Vinci Code. And to begin to find those connective threads is part of the, you know, the challenge, but also one of the rewards of the reporting is when you start to see this very, very blurry pictures start to come into focus.
Right. So you start kind of developing a theory that if Fritz is indeed a forger, perhaps he has targeted Karen King because she belongs to this school of thought that sex has been a focus of repression within the church, and that, you know, perhaps, you know, there's a dark history behind that. So you begin to kind of amass all of these findings and these theories about Fritz, and eventually you go back and you confront him again. What was that moment like?
So I called him, sort of cold called him, and I kind of just read him what I discovered, kind of giving him, you know, a sense that we should move past the point at which he's going to continue to lie to me, because he's already been photo ID'd by a former colleague of his in Berlin. I discovered the web domain, Gospel of Jesus' Wife. So we're at a point now where we should just be talking more freely. And, yeah, I wasn't confrontational about it. I just, you know, sort of read him what I discovered. And he, you know, at first lied to me again, said that, okay, well, maybe I know the person who owns the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, but I'm not going to tell you who that is. And in any case, if your concern is that it's a forgery, no owner has ever told Karen King that this thing is authentic. And I'm like, and I'm thinking about that. I'm saying, yes, he's right. No owner has ever told her it was authentic. The owner, whoever he was, and I didn't know who he was at that point, had told Karen King only that he had a papyrus that seemed to say something. He wasn't expert enough to tell her whether it was authentic or not, or even precisely what it said. So it was a kind of a there are a couple of distancing moves in this first interview with him. But on the other hand, towards the end of this like 4-hour interview, he tells me, can you just sit tight for a couple of weeks? In a couple of weeks, I may be able to tell you more. You know, those were probably the two most sleepless weeks of my life, because I was wondering what he was going to tell me in 2 weeks. I mean, I was fairly certain that he either was or knew the owner of the Gospel of Jesus' Wife at that point. But what he would come back with in 2 weeks, I could only guess at. And so
we're all sitting on the edge of our seats here.
Yeah, that's what remains.
So he gets back to you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, so in 2 weeks, I call him again, and he sends me a statement in which he acknowledges being the owner of the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, and in which he also emphatically denies having forged it or being aware of anyone else having forged it. So I want to make that clear as well. Walter Fritz told me he is the owner, but he was very emphatic about the fact that he did not forge this, and if it was a forgery, it wasn't something he had anything to do with.
I see. But you meet with him in person in Sarasota for sort of a final conversation, is that correct?
Right. So we continue to talk on the phone. I think I counted at one point. We had 11 interviews, something like that. And then he'd continue to tell me his version of the provenance story, which had all these different twists and turns that had never been made public before. We reached a point where eventually I said, okay, we'd love to photograph you for the magazine. Atlantic Magazine, where this story appeared. While we're out there photographing you, I'd love to finally have a chance to meet you. And he said yes to both, which of course made me happy. And I was, after having spent that much time, you know, learning about who he was and researching his life, it's always helpful, you know, just as a human being and also as a journalist to meet the subject of your story. So yeah, we spent a day together in Sarasota, Florida.
And there's kind of a final twist at the end of the story that is, I mean, it's the kind of thing that you really just can't make up. He suggests to you, sort of after you finish a recorded conversation, that you write a thriller that strongly resembles some of your very non-fictional reportage. So what is his proposition to you?
So, yeah, so at some point during the day, it was over lunch the first time, but then he raises it again later in the day. He leans across the table and says, I have an idea for you. And that idea involves my producing pages and pages of research for you for a thriller that you can write. And as he describes this thriller, it's looking, you know, almost like a perfect match for the Da Vinci Code. But essentially, in which he would do all the research into the Gnostic Gospels and early Christian history and provide for me all the background I need to write the book. Because he says his talent is in doing research and coming up with facts, and my talent is as a writer. I mean, he's flattering me. And I'm thinking, that I'm not a writer without facts. I'm a journalist. But that his argument was that I should do the writing, he should do the researching. It would take me years and years and years to do the kind of research he could probably do very quickly because he's already so deeply read in these matters. And I actually do think he's deeply read in these matters, but that's beside the point. He wanted me to write this thriller, and he told me that it would sell millions and millions.
Right, and you write a sentence in here that kind of encapsulates all of the irony in this moment where you say, I was reporting a story about a possible forger and the man at its center was asking me to, quote unquote, make a lot of stuff up. I mean, how were you feeling when he gave you this pitch?
I mean, in a state of disbelief at first that he would go there. I mean, even if that's something he fantasized about, having a thriller written around this, why would he tell me about it? Like, of all the people, I mean, I was very clear that, you know, we had a lot of questions about the papyrus, and I think this is, I've also been able to demonstrate that the provenance documents, including the sort of contract for the sale and these letters by the Berlin Egyptologist, this is a side story, but that those also appeared to be forgeries. This was something I was able to do through kind of forensic analysis of the stationery and some of the typescript. So we already knew at that point that I had some serious questions about the provenance. So for him to suggest that, I think at one point he said to me, the facts don't even always matter. What matters is entertainment. And part of me goes, well, what facts don't matter? And is all of this entertainment? I mean, so it just raised a lot of questions for me. And as a journalist who has dealt with various people who've told various shades of the truth over the years, you know, a lot of people who want reporters to go away either just don't talk to them or continue try to provide the reporter with a different impression than the one they have gotten from other sources.
Right. So the story comes out in July. It's now August. You had begun reporting on this in 2012. Are we any closer to understanding whether this document is indeed a fraud?
I mean, I think what we do have now for the first time, the day after my story went up on the Atlantic's website, Karen King, who hadn't cooperated with me during the reporting, called me up and said that she found the article really helpful. She now realizes that she'd been duped and that Walter Fritz had lied to her about who he was. And then for the first time anywhere, she told me that she now believes that the evidence tips the balance towards forgery. It was the first time she had said that anywhere. Prior to that, she felt that the evidence suggested that the papyrus was authentic. So now you have the Harvard professor who brought the papyrus into the world for the first time anywhere saying, I now believe that this is likely a forgery.
Well, it's an absolutely fascinating story and a really, you know, tremendous reporting effort of old-fashioned, gumshoe reporting along with document digging. And I hope that it does result in a book or a movie because it certainly read like one while I was going through it. So,
thank you. Well, stay tuned on that front. I will be writing. I can't think I can say too much more at this point, but I will be writing more about the Gospel of Joseph saga.
Well, we will look forward to it. In the meantime, Ariel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week.